Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 27th day of August. It is a Wednesday. It is 14 minutes now, actually, past 9 o'clock, and we are thrilled you are with us. We have a lot to discuss. It's a busy news day, as it usually is these days, and we'll talk about all of these issues with three incredible panelists who I will introduce in just a moment. We welcome you to be a part of the discussion. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin is here. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, you just said I was incredible, so I guess that makes me Mr. Incredible.
Mr. Incredible.
So, I'm doing well. Joe, just a public service announcement to remind everybody that the little ones are back to school beginning this week, but mostly next week. So give yourself a little more time on the roads, honor the school buses, and watch for the little ones run across the roads.
Yeah, they're getting used to the that pattern as well of the
and the weather's cooperating because it sort of feel like you need your winter coat out, so it's,
it's great. Good words, Bob, thank you very much.
I'm done for the day.
I know our our security and emergency preparedness expert reminding you, please don't run over the children. Alexander Mihailovic is a professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and is author of A Liberal Vanguard, Popular Elitism in the United States and Russia, and currently teaching at Middlebury.
Right, yeah.
Excellent. Well, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We also welcome the mayor of the city of Albany, New York. Kathy Sheehan is here. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am good, battling my seasonal allergies that I continue to be in denial about, but other than that, I'm just peachy.
Well, you know, it's an open phlegm zone here. Yeah. So you
if listeners want to send in, you know, various homespun remedies that they can recommend to me, that'd
right.
be welcome.
Honey cures everything.
my 3-year-old granddaughter certainly thinks
that's so. That's right. It's somebody from Eastern Europe.
Honey and ginger are usually the ones
that's a dynamite combination.
Are brought up most often. All right, let's get to the order of the day. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. This from the Washington Post, which they have established and labeled as breaking news, but D.C. judges and grand jurors are pushing back on Trump policing surge. This, of course, dealing with the story coming out of the District of Columbia, as well as the, I'll say the word, threat to other cities to have the National Guard move in. A federal magistrate judge said one arrest in D.C. was preceded by, quote, the most illegal search I've seen in my life. In another case, a grand jury refused three times to issue an indictment against a woman accused of assaulting a federal officer. These are all stories coming out of what is happening in Washington, D.C. Trump declared a crime emergency this month, giving federal law enforcement agencies and National Guard members unprecedented authority to patrol the nation's capital while also enlisting the district's 3,100-member police force to assist with immigration enforcement. More than 1,000 arrests have followed, according to the White House. Meanwhile, D.C.'s top prosecutor, Jeanine Pirro, ordered her staff to file the stiffest possible charges in every case. And this...
Just like her drinks.
This... this reporting... it was a low blow, but I'll allow. This reporting from the Washington Post. But there are emerging signs that not all of the arrests will stand up to scrutiny in court. A federal grand jury on three separate occasions this month refused to indict a D.C. woman who was accused of assaulting an FBI agent. An extraordinary rejection of the prosecution's case. Days later, a federal magistrate judge said an arrest in Northeast Washington was preceded by the most illegal search I've seen in my life, and described another arrest as lacking, quote, basic human dignity. While judges are known to criticize prosecutors from time to time, grand jurors only in rare cases refuse to issue an indictment, which requires them to find only probable cause that a crime was committed, the lowest evidentiary bar in the legal system. Instances of failed indictments have begun to crop up more since Trump took office this year. Grand jurors in Los Angeles have rejected indictments of people who were arrested for protesting the administration's immigration enforcement actions, that according to the Los Angeles Times. The July 22nd scuffle at issue in D.C. federal court occurred weeks before Trump's law enforcement order, but the grand jurors were presented with the case this month just as federal agents were descending on Washington. Prosecutors alleged that Sidney Reed was obstructing and recording agents from the FBI and U.S. Immigration and Custom Enforcement as they attempted to arrest a gang member being released from the D.C. jail who was slated for deportation. An FBI agent scraped her hand against a wall amid the fracas. And prosecutors plan to charge Reed with assaulting, resisting, or impeding a federal officer, a felony offense punishable by up to 8 years in prison. The stories can go on and on, but under the Fifth Amendment, charges that carry potential penalties of more than a year in prison must be approved by at least 12 members of a grand jury. Where does this bring us, do you think, Mayor, especially as we're talking about the president is talking about expanding this program?
I think that it should give everyone in this country pause. We have civilian police forces that have protected our communities for centuries. Very different than an occupying force of National Guard, and very different training that one receives in the FBI. So there is a huge difference between your civilian police report force, over which ultimately the people have a voice. Right. They elect mayors. Mayors appoint police chiefs. And so there's a local accountability that we've experienced here in Albany when people have not liked the way that the police have responded. And so we have, for example, in the city of Albany, a civilian police review board. We have an advisory committee that advises the police department. But every locality is different. But I think it's really important for people to understand that the National Guard is not trained to police. They are not trained on this to the same degree as police officers are on things like de-escalation, constitutional rights, search and seizure. Those are not things that are part of the training that these individuals receive. They're trained to go in and stabilize, occupy, but that one-on-one engagement of arresting individuals, of policing, it's a very different job. And I think it's really important that we recognize that this is not the path that we want to go down unless people truly believe that we should live in a military dictatorship.
It does seem, Bob Griffin, that every day there is something that ups the ante, and that there is another action that is mentioned by the administration that will further and make this, well, I would say more onerous, but will certainly heighten it. Yesterday, during the power hours of the cabinet meeting, which we'll talk about, Trump called for the death penalty in all D.C. Murder cases. Now, it's not at all clear how the president could carry out such a directive. But the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory death sentences were unconstitutional, about a half century ago. And yet, this is again upping the ante.
It is, Joe, and you know, I view it as this is red meat for the base. I think that you see these increasingly absurd and authoritarian movements by Trump as you start to see his poll numbers continuing to decline. You see even members of his base starting to question things like the Epstein files and what his administration is doing as far as the public release of documents. You're seeing the tariffs really starting to chew into the economy. You see a general malaise on this country. The truth of the matter is that this administration has been an abject failure so far. And the cracks are really starting to show. And the way he's papering over the cracks in his policies and administration is by pushing the envelope on areas in an attempt to draw attention away from others. The other part of this that I think is that would be remiss if we don't talk about, he's already gearing up. Trump is already gearing up for the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. He can't run on the economy. He can't run on our international prestige. He can't run on his failed foreign policies in achieving peace anywhere in the globe. He's gonna count on crime. So he's creating these myths about the how foul the blue state or democratic controlled cities are, that they're truly just crime ridden, and that we have to send the military in as a way of trying to reshape the whole narrative on what is going on in the economy and what's going on in the country. The mayor raises, I think, some really interesting questions that we should talk about. Like, okay, where is the line that we want as a people between our civil liberties, our capacity to live, and our capacity to live safely? I've said multiple times on the show, I don't trust the government, and this is someone who has worked in government for close to 40 years. And I think it's part of our patriotic responsibility to question government. But now I'm questioning the military. Now I'm questioning law enforcement. And again, all of these actions begin to have a significant fraying of the social compact between me as a citizen and the government, particularly the enforcement arms. I think Tamir is absolutely correct. The military was never designed to do law enforcement. In fact, if you go back to Posse Comitatus, but also you start to think about the basic training that goes on. In fact, one of the biggest criticisms internationally of our military is that they're wonderful at winning wars, right? Destroying tanks and critical infrastructure, they're absolutely abysmal at state building, as we've seen in places like Afghanistan. And yet, all of a sudden, we're going to try to expand the militarized presence of this quasi military in ICE and its allies in law enforcement into only blue cities. And as I said last week on the show, Joe, it's interesting to me that if you look at the murder rates in D.C. versus Memphis, which is higher, right. New Orleans, which is higher, these red states, both of whom governors have sent National Guards troops to D.C. when their own cities have higher murder rates. Mm. It shows the partisan the partisan bend of this, which is really terrifying, because I mean he's making no bones about it that he will target democratic leaning states and jurisdictions in the most partisan way that I've ever seen in my career.
Well, in addition, all of the data that I've seen out there shows that the murder rate is lower in states with no deaths. Penalty than it is in states that have death penalties.
There's no correlation at all between death penalty and the other. The other part of it that I personally believe, and I'm interested for the panel to talk about this if they think I'm right or wrong. I also think what this is doing is that he's trying to head off protests that he knows his policies are unpopular. I mean, he knows that the big beautiful bill is generally despised across the country. And that as the economy continues to fray, at the same time we're going to start to see and feel the impacts of cutbacks in the social safety nets. People's ability and willingness to go to the streets is going to be different when you're looking at masked armed thugs.
I mean, I think another aspect of this is what seems to me is that Trump's administration is plugging into a very specific school of conservatism that is largely not a part of American conservatism, which is the fetishization, idolatry of the state. This really struck me in Trump 1 when Stephen Miller, very early on in that administration, said, this was in regard to a disagreement between Congress and Trump. I can't remember which exact law Trump wanted to push through, but he wasn't able to push it through it. But Miller said the will of the president will be obeyed. And as somebody who comes from an immigrant background from Eastern Europe, this struck me as being very resonant with a particular kind of, I don't know what you would call it, a European tradition of hardcore conservatism, where the state, the government, is actually your friend. And this is largely, a notion, a belief, which really runs against the grain of any number of different American conservative traditions, whatever one might think of them. Certainly libertarianism is one of those, now the state is something that, we should enlist as our ally. The state should take over business. The state should take over institutions. And we see this across the board in terms of any number of different American conservative, I would say, religious movements are now very friendly to this idea. For example, the New Apostolic Reformation among some Protestant groups, they want the state to have become fully entrenched as a kind of a Christian institution with multiple arms. And again, this was largely not even the moral majority under Reagan and Jerry Falwell encouraged this kind of expansive understanding of the American government as something that should get involved in the grassroots of how we conduct our daily lives.
But it's so focused on Trump.
Yeah.
So Trump spent all of his campaign telling us that we couldn't trust government, that it was wasteful, that it was infested with woke ideology. It was not something to be trusted. And now it is, but now that I'm in charge, I am going to make government ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And the federal government is going to decide these very hyper-local issues that most Americans, I do believe, support being hyper-local. People want to decide these things for themselves and for their communities. And so it is a very, I think, dangerous path that we're on. And as we look at what's happening next year and the midterms and the facts that in many instances, we don't have confidence that the court's going to step in. I mean, you talk about the institutions. This is a full government takeover of everything from the Smithsonian institutions to the Congressional Library to your local police department. And that is the path that we are on, and I think it's very intentional. And it is the ultimate aim that Trump has. He wants to be in charge.
It's very strange, though, because if you're asserting this level of control at both the federal, state, and local level, this requires a metastasis of any number of different bureaucratic organizations and entities and categories. This is going to explode government. It is not going to slim it down. If you're serious about this kind of thing, and sometimes I wonder, maybe they aren't, because if you want to slim down the government, but you're also saying you want to have more control over, cultural institutions and other kinds of institutions, this you need a kind of enormous footprint in terms of funding, it seems to me.
But that's what he's fine with funding government. I mean, look at what they did with ICE. You know, ICE's budget has now increased to, it would be the top 20 militaries of the world just for ICE.
Right.
And he's cutting back on things that frankly he doesn't care about. I mean, he doesn't care about libraries. He doesn't care about culture. He's certainly not worried about going hungry, or his grandkids or kids starving. I mean, so all of these all of these issues, he's fine in growing government, and I view this as this is the ultimate power grab. Because if midterms go the way I hope midterms go, the very first thing a new Congress is going to do is going to end his use of emergency powers and executive orders to rule by fiat, which is pretty much what he's doing right now. You know, the idea of signing an executive order that somehow creates a law about banning flag burning. I mean, where is Congress? And you know, I think, you know, I have said it multiple times on the show. I mean, we're, you know, for the congressional members in the jurisdictions that are listening in right now that we broadcast to, every member of Congress should be stepping up and saying that's not acceptable.
But they're terrified.
This is just, Kathy. Yeah. They are. And if you're that terrified, then get the heck out of the way.
But I don't see that happening. I mean, you have an individual who has 34 felony convictions saying he has the authority to fire a Fed governor because there's a whisper that she might have done something wrong. Right. So this is, I mean, this is what he did with Zelensky. You know, it's what he did with the Russians. Like, I want people who will dig up dirt on my enemies, on people that I want to get rid of. They will curry favor with me. They've eliminated what the estimate is now 300,000 positions in the government that he wants to fill with those who will do his bidding. And so, you know, I think he is sending a message, and you know, there are people fighting back, but I don't know what's going to happen to Lisa Cook when this ultimately gets to the Supreme Court. They've given this president great latitude, and they gave him great latitude in their decision that gives him immunity.
Yeah.
And so he can bring in a whole group of people and say, break the law. Not, you know, not, hey, I want to go up to the line, right? I really want to go hard on this, which some leaders do, but don't cross the line. This is a guy who's like, cross the line and I'll pardon you.
And that's
not
what,
a problem.
That's what Miller was saying, right? And, yeah. I mean, but you're hitting a couple of points. I mean, the problem, the concern I have is that you have an administration now that has enough maliciousness in it to actually carry out 2025. Project 2025. You have a court at the highest level that is, frankly, has been and is illegitimate with not a bit of personal ethics. If you think about Alito, you think about Thomas, you think about Roberts, okay, you think about Kavanaugh. And each one of these dominoes, they thought they were playing their little partisan games. And now all of a sudden they're worried that the rabid dog at the end of the chain is uncontrollable. It is because of what they did. And go all the way back to Citizens United.
Yeah.
Okay. Roberts in the court have set this country up for failure. Mm-hmm. Now the only thing that I will note is that if the winds do turn, you know, an ex administration coming in can actually have the same powers that Trump do, although it's hard to imagine anybody who would abuse it the way he is.
I mean, this you can go you can trace a lot of this not just to the, you know, Citizens United, but also I would say even the Watergate, you know, era,
sure.
where there was a great deal of kind of robust discussion about what was then called the Imperial Presidency, which was a title also a very interesting book by a political scientist, Richard Pius, who taught at Barnard College, and who was there referred to as the Pope, because he was such a kind of flamboyant lecturer. But I think that one of the things that's, this has really, provoked a lot of people to sort of think about the notion of the unitary executive, which was also, came to the fore, right after 9/11 with John Ashcroft, who argued together with John Yoo at the University of California, Berkeley Law School, that, in fact, the president can do whatever he wants, that this is a very specific way of looking at the Constitution, and specifically the 18th century and 18th century English. What did the framers of the Constitution have in mind when they used the term executive?
Yeah.
But this is a distinctly pre-modern understanding of political power, of American political power. It seems to me
it's true, and I would argue now that the decision not to prosecute Nixon was probably one of the worst decisions that we made. It was right for right for that moment. Long term, I think it's led to in part where we are right now. One of the themes I think, regardless of which story we talk about right now, is this whole notion of we're giving up on the future of this country, whether it's the push to smear members of the Fed so that he can force a higher rate change that would alleviate some of the political pressure he's feeling because of his tax break for the rich. What that does long term is it takes away the tools that we have to deal with the issues of inflation and a weaker dollar. I mean, so you start to think about what we're trading off right now. The fact that we're trading regulations in science for things like protecting clean air and clean water, because it's just not expedient right now. But what it does is it screws the kids that are in the future are going to have to live with those health issues. I mean, this is all everything we're doing right now is trading our future for the whims of this dude.
Well, they're not going to be exposed to red dye, but they are going to be exposed to lead, mercury, and other poisons.
Yeah.
Mm. Let's take a pause. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's only Wednesday. It's only Wednesday. But Monday, the president held an Oval Office meeting. And it was to sign, I believe, two executive orders. It went on for over 90 minutes. And I know this is probably heresy coming from a journalist of any stripe, but remember the good old days when you used to say, well, it's about time the president had a press availability that we haven't seen or heard from them in months. Well, we're hearing from Donald Trump every single solitary day. And yesterday, it went on for almost 4 hours. And that was during the cabinet meeting. And it is choreographed by Donald Trump. And a lot of the things that we are talking about and that we have talked about this morning and that we have talked and that we will talk about today are sort of these, okay, I did this. Well, you think that's something? I'm going to do this. Well, you think that's something? Well, I'm going to do this. And it just it raises it's upping the ante almost at every sycophant who is around the table who starts off by saying how wonderful the president is and then offers some other policy that is equally outrageous in some way, shape, or form that has become. And I remember talking about this 10 years ago. We have to be careful because we're normalizing it. Well, it's normalized now, right? Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's the Keister kissing cabinet, right? I mean, he put a cabinet in place that he knew would never impeach him for his incompetence. And that's what we got. I mean, I looked at the picture from the cabinet meeting, and I thought, you know, it looked like a collection of folks that are absolutely incompetent and unworthy of sitting in that building.
Well, and I think the other piece of it is that, you know, he certainly has not surrounded himself by people who will tell him what he needs to know.
No.
He has surrounded him by people who will only tell him what he wants to hear. And as he embarks on the nationalization of multiple industries, and that's what's happening here, let's just remember that this is a man who bankrupted 7 companies.
Mm-hmm. Including casinos.
Yeah.
And university. Which state companies.
Yeah. I mean, the entire meeting in the cabinet room was, you know, absolutely surreal. It reminded me of the, you know, the very well-known event in the Soviet Presidium under Stalin, where people were trying, members of the people in the room were seeing who could clap the longest and the loudest, you know. And so they were all trying to sort of outdo each other, you know, in praising, you know, the general secretary of the Communist Party. This is something very much like that. And also just kind of the way in which, for example, RFK Jr. was repeating these memes of Trump that just seemed completely outside even his bailiwick, saying, for example, yes, you are right about the hazards of wind farms. As far as I know, RFK Jr. had nothing to say about, as loony as many of his statements have been. This is the first time he's like broached that, and he also said, and you are going to save the whales? I mean, this is just kind of a complete, you know, deterioration of discourse, you know, on a basic level.
I mentioned this yesterday. There's a lot about carp.
Yeah.
And whales in the president's speech. I was, as I was listening to it, and I will admit I couldn't turn it off. I wanted to, but I couldn't turn it off. But I do remember the first, I believe it was the first televised cabinet meeting that he did this, where everyone was supposed to kiss the ring, and in the first administration. And they got all the way to, I believe it was Rex Tillerson. Mm. And Tillerson says, yeah, you're fine. You know, it's like, bam, you're all right. And I thought that was just the best. You know, but I believe in recorded history of this administration that Tillerson was the only person to dare, and he only lasted less than 12 months. So.
Even though his nickname was T-Rex.
Yes, exactly.
Well, maybe we'll get lucky, and if we start nationalizing industries, we could move into healthcare and things like that. So that would maybe.
Right? And that's, you know, that's what I said.
If that would be socialism.
If we nationalize healthcare, you might see people rallying around and supporting that.
Yeah.
But it's, again, the track record here is not one that inspires a lot of confidence. And you guys have crushed all hope that I had that there might be some will within the corporate community, the moneyed community, to say, well, wait a minute, I don't want to report to the guy. I just want to get, you know, outrageously ludicrous and lucrative tax cuts from him. Mm-hmm. But that's what will happen, is that these corporate CEOs will be ultimately reporting to the president of the United States. And they'll have to sit in a room for 3.5 hours and tell him how wonderful he is.
But American business is not doing very well at the moment, you know, on the whole. I mean, the tariffs, you know, are cutting into their profit margins because people are buying less, you know, because of inflation. So at some point, the shoe is going to drop. I mean, you know, at some point, you're going to get, you know, what's going to kick in again is Calvin Coolidge's, you know, famous sentiment, the business of America is business. And I don't see that he's okay, aside from these, you know, tax breaks for some, you know, some corporations and, you know, magnates. I don't see that he's really engaging in policies that are helping, you know, American business as a whole and its you know, profile in the world. He wants autarky, you know, which is, you know, all, which is by definition disengaging from the larger world. But we can't turn that clock back, it seems to me.
And you also, you hear these stories about Bill Gates and the foundation quietly cutting ties with firms linked to Democrats. Mm-hmm. You hear about Gates meeting with Trump to discuss a global health report. So this continues. There's what we know of that's in front of us that's being presented at a cabinet meeting or at an executive order signing. And then there's what's happening behind the scenes as well.
Well, and I think we need to be a little bit careful too, that the CEOs are now making such obscene amounts of money that downturns in their businesses don't affect them. I mean, they're so insulated from the rest of us that. It's more about ego and game and membership in the club, Joe. And I think that's, you know, what you're getting to is that it's the oligarchs are completely entrenched. And even a downturn in the economy isn't going to affect their, you know, okay, so, you know, you're only making $170 million, not $250 million. I mean, it's not like they're looking like they're going to have to go live on the sidewalk.
Yeah, but I think that presumes that a cataclysmic decline in the economy wouldn't result in action that would happen among the rest of us, right? They're only 5 to 1%, and I think when you look at the social upheaval, the small businesses, which are really the lifeblood of the economy, that are
right
being
now.
Impacted by this, that you would not see. Consequences of that, and I get self-interest, I do, but historically we have also had leaders, whether they be in the corporate realm or in the government realm, who have looked at these bellwethers and at the fact that in order to have a civil society, we cannot have starvation, chaos, ruin, thousands of people unemployed, and what we saw during the Great Depression.
You see, and that's the problem, Kathy. I don't think that the group of oligarchs with Trump really care about civil society. And I think they have no problem in jetting off to their own private islands. They all have their own militias. If you think about the security that they have around themselves, they now have the trappings of the United States military to protect them. I think that in no time in recent history have we seen a greater threat than we do right now, and this idea that somehow they are part of our civil society, I don't think they view it that way. I really don't. I think they are so separated from the pain and suffering that goes on in the challenges that most people have that they can't even begin to conceptualize what you're talking about.
Letters from our audience. Linda says the Iowa Senate just flipped a Republican seat. Does the panel think this may be a hopeful sign for the midterms? Well, we'll take whatever hopeful sign we can get, right?
Yeah, no. I mean, it was Senate seat one. It was. I think it happened last night. Yeah, because I was looking at some of the stats this morning. Is it a hopeful sign? Yeah. Am I popping champagne yet? No, I think there's an awful lot of hard work. And honestly, I think there's a lot of messaging that the Democrats need to do on things like crime, on things like what are they going to do differently? And I'm not sure, again, that the party overall has laid out a cogent position to combat what is going on. They've been successful in kind of keeping their mouth shut and letting Trump sort of run things into the ground, but that's not going to see them through the way they're going to need to be.
Well, and can I just say to your last comment, because I do want to have hope, and this is going to seem like an odd statement to say with the word hope, but the Romanov family was beheaded. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but there is only a certain level of inequity that can exist in any country before there is revolt. And I'm not suggesting that we're at that moment in time, but I do think that even with the arrogance of the oligarchs that exists and their private islands, at some point in time, history repeats itself. And they need to look at those lessons. And I think take heed of what history has showed us.
And you don't think that Musk is thinking about that for his star base on Mars? I mean, you know, it's I'm with you. I mean, I not that I'm looking for a revolution. And, you know, I also note that the Romanovs weren't able to get into their own private jet or helicopter and get the heck out of Russia. But I think the resources that are available right now, and the fact that I have no faith in things like the American justice system to hold these oligarchs accountable. I mean, so that's the other element of it, is that if all of government is weighed against the people the way it's being set up to be, it's going to take an awful lot to fix the course of where we're at now.
I think in terms of, you know, the Romanovs, one thing to sort of bear in mind is that, you know, quite a bit of their downfall had to do with the complacency that they had about their institutions and their way of doing things. And they're frankly hubris, you know. I mean, there's this famous, very amusing, you know, anecdote of the Russian Navy under Nicholas II saying, oh, we don't need all these warships. Why don't we sell, you know, some of them off? So they sell a couple of them to Italy, which then sells them to Japan, that then used it in the Battle of Tsushima in 1904, 1905, which was, you know, during the Russo-Japanese War, which was a complete, utter military and diplomatic disaster for the Russian Empire that led ultimately to the downfall of the Russian Empire. And we're, you know, I think, you know, there's room for hope in right now, in the sense that, you know, the Trump administration is not doing well diplomatically. It hasn't scored any victories, for example, in Gaza or in Ukraine. There's no palpable good outcome in either of these places, even though he's trying to run the victory lap about them. So I think that, you know, this points to, you know, possible, you know, changes down the road, I think, in terms of people's perception.
There are military troops being sent into the United States cities. There are innocent people being rounded up for no good reason. And yet we are getting our jumpers in a bunch over the rebranding of Cracker Barrel.
Yep.
And my head is ready to explode.
Right. I think we has to be present company excluded.
No, but I will say, when you look at the vitriol and the anger that comes on an issue like that, enough, by the way, that it caused a change, a reversal. I agree with you. I like the word revolt. I like the fact that of your idea for hope, but it just seems to me like we're getting upset about, really, Cracker Barrel?
Well, New Coke caused quite the stir back in the day.
And now they're going to change the sugar in that? I'm telling you.
I can't speak to Cracker Barrel. I know you wanted to talk about it, but I had probably one of the most subpar dining experiences of my life at a Cracker Barrel near Allentown, Pennsylvania, sometime in the late 90s, and I've never gone back. So I am not qualified to speak on Cracker Barrel.
My intention is not to disparage Cracker Barrel by any stretch of the imagination. I think they serve their public well. However, it's the idea of this is what gets people jacked out of shape.
12 trans athletes. 12. Across the country. And it became the cornerstone of putting a felon into the White House.
Right.
So one of the things that they're masters at is figuring out what are the trigger points for a plurality of folks, and that's what they're pushing.
I mean, I think that the whole thing with Cracker Barrel, which is pretty amusing in the sense it's like it's just a bog bubble, really, you know. But on the other hand, as Jamel Bowie from the New York Times has pointed out, You know, what the Trump administration here is clearly doing, not even dog whistling their white supremacist supporters, they're actively bullhorning them. Yeah. Because, you know, the big fuss was about the removal of a clearly elderly white man from the logo of Cracker Barrel and just having, you know, the name without any image. And this was sort of ginned up as some kind of, you know, form of a white replacement or erasure.
I'll be honest with you. You know, tooling down the highway at 55 miles an hour, I could not even tell that that was a guy, a human. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I never noticed that.
Yeah, I never thought about it. I never looked at the image closely, to be honest.
No, exactly. Rebranding was just, it's Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, but anyway.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our riveting conversation, and we'll go on and many other... Take on another fast food establishment. And we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is here. We also have Alexander Mihailovich, who is Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, and the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We've opened a lot of can of worms in the first hour, so I just want to give the listeners a chance to sound off on some of these things. Jim in Bennington says, good morning, panel. Although Franklin probably said it in a different context, his literal words come to mind today. Quote, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. That from Jim. Yep. We now go to Frank in Cherry Valley. Hello, panel. Respectfully, I think Bob is way off in the assessment of Trump's running points. We know from repeated examples, starting with the twisted spin on the January 6th insurrection, that the MAGA group will believe anything he says. So saying that he can't run on international relations, the economy, etc., goes against evidence that he makes lies part of the narrative. What does the Democratic Party answer with? Running against the Trump lies was not enough to win 2024, and I don't think it'll be enough in 2028. 2026 will need to be the point where Dems hold the line if we are ever going to have a chance to get back to some sense of democracy. I fear, quote-unquote, truth will not seem to be enough to turn the Trump radicals.
I don't think the letter writer is far off. I do agree with him that I think 2026 is even more important now than I had ever imagined. I think my comments were more about there isn't a substantive policy victory that Trump can point to that helps the majority of people in this country. So, you know, if he had achieved a lasting peace in Gaza or in the Ukraine, if he had actually brought in real economic deals with international partners, I mean, anything. He hasn't delivered anything so far. And you're right. He's going to lie about it. And the question is, what percentage of the people are going to believe the lies or not?
Are they going to believe him, or are they going to believe their own experience? That's the question. I mean, if you know, are they going to believe him or their own pocketbooks?
They've been very good in believing him. I mean, we all watched January 6th, and that in itself should have been, in my mind, I mean, he should be in prison for that right now. And yet he's not in prison, neither are the people that tried to implement the insurrection.
Yeah, and I think that the mantra is that we just need to wait because this is part of his plan. And when it's all implemented and when we follow him down this path, it is going to be spectacular. And so they still hold on to that, notwithstanding their own circumstances, their inability to access healthcare, the fact that they get a notification that they are no longer going to be able to access the prescription drugs, you know, at a rate that is affordable to them. I mean, all of that. I think that there's still this blind faith that somehow this is all part of a master plan designed to help them.
Mm. Well, that plugs into the sort of conspiratorial thinking of, you know, QAnon and other movements. Mm-hmm. You know, QAnon's mantra was trust the plan. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that there's quite a bit of carryover here in terms of that. And I think also we need to bear in mind the importance of certain tendencies in American religious life that encourage this form of thinking. The United States is a very, in many ways, devout country. I mean, I find it as a Russia special kind of sort of amusing that people point right now to the Russian Federation as being this very godly Christian country with its, you know, anti-LGBTQ policies. But, you know, last week there came out the statistic, only 1% of the Russian population that considers itself to be Christian Orthodox went to a Christmas service. 1% of the entire population. And, you know, you compare that to, for example, the statistics in terms of church attendance to the major holidays across denominations, the United States, is enormous. So I think, again, reality is going to come up against, you know, Trump's grandiose claims at some point. So we'll see what, you know, there are hints of that already beginning to happen here and there on the local level, it seems to me.
Let's go back to letters from our listeners, and we get this one from Dan, who says, we mentioned this, but Memphis, with one of the highest rates of violent crime, is ignored by the governor while he sends troops to D.C. We're seeing that in mm-hmm. Tennessee mm-hmm. and other places.
But they're doing
well.
A heck of a job picking up the trash in D.C. because, I mean, that's the picture they saw yesterday. So thanks, Tennessee, for picking up the trash in D.C. I'm sure the taxpayers love that.
Who is this letter from? I don't know, but it doesn't matter. We'll say anonymous. If Trump and his sycophants want to decrease violence in our cities, how about some reasonable gun control? The Dems yeah. should be all over this. Isn't yeah. it obvious that Trump is preparing for the midterm elections? And thank you to that listener. We go to...
Can I just speak to that? Because, yes, gun control, common sense gun control. We just saw the seizure of hundreds of guns, not just in the city of Albany, but throughout the region mm-hmm. in a major operation that was undertaken as a joint operation among both local law enforcement and the FBI. So common sense gun control. When people say that they're afraid, I do think that they are speaking to the fact that you can't go anywhere and not worry that somebody with a semi-automatic rifle and a chip on their shoulder or a serious mental health issue could open fire. And that is not unique to urban centers. In fact, it's, you know, happening everywhere in our schools, shopping malls, you name it. So, yeah, that's scary. But I think the other piece of this is that we know that when we have social networks that work, that it helps to reduce crime. When you look at the huge drop-off in crime that happened after the 1990s, there were concerted efforts that happened among policymakers to look at the impacts of poverty, of lack of access to jobs, of lack of access to health care, and we got many of those things right. Those strategies and those interventions worked. And the reason I know they worked is because when they fell apart during the COVID pandemic, we saw a large spike in crime. It's not that difficult to figure out. Trump doesn't want you to connect the dots, but I sure as hell can connect the dots as a mayor who's on the street in a community and saw it firsthand.
Yeah.
These systems are designed to help keep us safer. And when they went away, because of COVID, because people stayed home, we had to shift and pivot what probation officers and law enforcement and the courts shut down, people weren't sentenced, all of those things happened, and we saw a spike in crime. And as we have seen all of those institutions reset and go back to their core missions, we've seen a huge reduction in crime. These things work. So it's not just gun control, but I agree with that. We need common sense gun control. It's also acknowledging and recognizing that these social systems that we have put in place are helping to keep us safe. And when we take those away, that is when I think we have even greater threats.
Allison writes to us and says, "Hi, panel. Thanks for your ideas and opinions. I have heard the Republicans want less government as opposed to Democrats with all their social programs. How might a MAGA or a sane Republican account for slash defend all the things that Trump is doing as, quote unquote, less government?" Then we go to this listener.
Well, we're so far, Joe, if I could just say this, though. We're so far away from traditional conservative ideals that there is no comparison between where the GOP is today versus where it has been in any point in its lifetime. This is non-recognizable. I mean, think about what he's doing with his fat fingers in industry and the misuse of military on the streets. This isn't conservatism.
Yeah. Let's go to Liz, who writes, "Hi, panel. In my view, admittedly, I'm not a constitutional historian or expert. I think the framers intended the, quote-unquote, executive to be a functionary. They hated the monarchy. Many of them worried about a president becoming another King George. That's why the executive must make sure the laws, all laws, are faithfully enforced. That's why Congress is Article I. Thanks for your wonderful discussions." Mm-hmm. That from Liz in Kingston. We go to Jim. Good morning, panel. I think I read Jim's letter before, and I did not take it out of the mix. However, I do have this from Stuart, who says, "Nicole Wallace of MSNBC, soon to be MS Now." Mm-hmm.
Was there uproar over that change?
Yeah, I had uproar. I don't know about anyone else, but Nicole Wallace had the perfect metaphor for our creeping authoritarianism. Put a live frog into a pot of boiling water and it will immediately scramble to jump out. Put the frog in a pot of tepid water and turn the heat to boil and it lies there passively, not realizing that it's cooking until it's too late. She ends with a question, "Hey, is it hot enough for you yet?" That from Stuart. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I hope the frog got out safely.
Well, and I think that, you know, to the writer who talked about our early framers of the Constitution and what they were concerned about, when you look at history and you know, I think Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals is a great example of it. Jay Winnick, April 1865, the month that saved America. You know, these are historians telling us about remarkable people doing things that if they had made a different choice, we would be a different country. And so I think we've always relied on, I mean, historically, the honor and dignity of men, but really of people to make self-sacrifice and to make decisions that are in the interest of all people in this country, as opposed to necessarily their own self-interest. And that, I think, is what has died. Not only do we not see it, but it is defined as woke. It's swept up in wokeness.
Well, I think to me, the bigger story, believe it or not, isn't Trump, it's Congress. It's the fact that Congress has traded away the people's power to this. And I actually can envision discussions going on in the gilded brothel that we call the Oval Office now, that every day they go—
And the cabinet room we learned yesterday. You see that? That's now—
Yeah, but every day they go, "I can't believe
we're
getting away with this," that he pushes, and nobody has put their foot down and said, no, you can't do this. And that's and that's at first with Congress. And he's getting away with it. He's getting away with it every single day because Congress isn't doing their jobs.
There are no profiles in Courage. I mean,
none.
I think people looked at what happened to Liz Cheney. They looked at what happened, and they're protecting their own self-interest, their own seat, their own egos. These are not honorable people.
No.
Period. Full stop.
And Liz Cheney's a nut, and we think that she's sane right now.
Well, these are people who are not thinking about the Constitution in like a very basic way. I mean, for example, the whole matter of the military being on the streets. This is quite clearly, palpably against the Constitution.
Right.
I mean, people often, you know, who are so-called pro-gun activists, you know, cite the Second Amendment. But there's a part of the Second Amendment that people, they often, and many people in general, don't talk about, which is the maintenance of a free-standing militia. And this is language that is very, very deliberate because of the colonial, negative colonial American experience of contact with the British Army, mm-hmm. specifically the Boston Massacre of 1770. The whole notion of a military, which is absolutely, in terms of the European experience, an arm of the monarch or whatever chief executive there is at the head of the government, coming on soil and demanding tribute and some form of social control, this is something that is, you know, speaks directly to the American experience in the drafting of the early articles of the American Constitution. There's something else here I think is very important historically to bear in mind. How did the Boston Massacre occur? It was because the British Army, over a period of several months, was trying to extract money for the tariffs that Britain was imposing on the North American colonists. And now we're in a state where we have a government that is engaging in tariff policy globally. Essentially, Trump is putting himself in the position of, you know, of the what then would have been considered to be something very close to the role of the British Crown. And yet people are simply not seeing this. You know, why? Because they don't consider the Constitution to be a probative document, it seems to me. It is something now that is sidelined, and that actually, if you dig deep enough on the far right or even, you know, the right internet right now, which has now become essentially mainstream, the Constitution is woke or it's too woke. This is beginning to become a talking point.
Yeah, and Trump said the other day that, you know, people want him to be a dictator. I mean, he's throwing these things out and he's not getting any pushback.
No. People like it. If we need a dictator, we've got to have a dictator. If I'm a dictator, okay. I'm getting stuff done, and you can go get your coffee without getting knifed.
I mean, this is maybe getting a little bit into the weeds of all this question of what kind of dictatorship people, are now sort of have been bringing all these analogies to, you know, Italy and Germany during the Second World War. It seems to me that maybe a more accurate but no less disquieting comparison would be Franco's Spain. In terms of the kind of bringing together of a certain kind of fundamentalist religious vision, a notion of, you know, the chief executive or leader as some kind of moral crusader, that was very much a part of the landscape of Franco's Spain, beginning with the Spanish Revolution until his death. So.
I just had this moment yesterday when I was watching the clip of RFK Jr. and Pete Hegseth doing their push-up off. Did you see this?
I did.
No, I'm afraid to ask what this was.
So they test their fitness, and they have this competition with each other where they would do 50 pull-ups and 100 push-ups in 10 minutes or less. And I have this fear that I'm going to go on a Sunday night to watch 60 Minutes, and all I'm going to see is like this Pete and Bobby challenge.
But that's exactly,
which is by the way what they call it. Go ahead.
But that's exactly what they're setting up. And if you think about it, I mean, they have successfully gone after, I think, neutered the mainstream press. I don't think the mainstream press is I don't get my news from the mainstream press because there is no news there.
Well, and I think, you know, when we talk about where we are and you know, that the Constitution is too woke, I mean, I think we have to push back and say what people are saying. I mean, I'm not woke. I'm educated. Mm. And yet that is a nasty word,
yeah.
Right? Mm. We consider that now to be, we're gonna eliminate the Department of Education. We don't want our young people educated broadly. We don't want expansive ideas. We don't want slavery brought up in our museums, you know. So I think that is also part of what we're seeing here. And when I say educated, I'm not talking about my college education or the fact that I have a JD. The things that we're talking about today on this panel, I learned in high school. These are things I learned in high school. You know, when I learned history and when I took, social studies and current events. So this is what we're really losing is, and when you think about how you create a pathway for this to be sustainable, that is how you do it, by convincing people that simply by being educated, simply by reading three different sources, three different versions of the same history, that is somehow un-American.
We are going to go to a break. I just want to mention the breaking news out of Minneapolis, a South Minneapolis church, where a large law enforcement presence has responded after multiple residents have reported hearing a lengthy burst of gunfire. The Minneapolis mayor, Jacob Frey, F-R-E-Y, said that he was, quote, monitoring reports of, quote, horrific violence in South Minneapolis. I'm in touch with Chief O'Hara, and our emergency response team has been activated. That posted on X. We will share more information as soon as we can. Please give our officers the space they need to respond to the situation. This is at the Annunciation Church this morning in Minneapolis, Minnesota, just about 20 minutes ago as the story broke. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation, wrap up, have our last half hour of conversation on all kinds of issues. We have much more to get to, and we'll do that. We always welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, and we will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. How are you all doing? We welcome you, and thank you very much for being with us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we want to get to some other topics and items of discussion. I will say that so much came out of this as far as just this one upsmanship that happened at the cabinet meeting yesterday was interesting to follow. So some of these stories all merge into one another as being a result of that particular meeting. But I would like to put a spotlight on the on Trump officials discussing ownership stakes in defense firms. And this from the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick. And he said they're looking into whether the federal government could make a stake in private defense companies like Lockheed Martin. This is days after President Donald Trump announced such a deal with chipmaker Intel, according to Lutnick. And what is interesting about this, the Commerce Secretary said there is not just a discussion, but a monstrous discussion among administration officials about making deals similar to what the president announced last week with Intel. Why shouldn't the U.S. government say, you know what? We use these services. We would like a piece of it. We use Boeing services. We'd like a piece of Boeing. This from host Andrew Ross Sorkin of Squawk Box asking Lutnick about the U.S. governmental potentially becoming the largest shareholder of Intel, a private tech company, and pressed him on where the Trump administration would draw the line. Lutnick said there was, in fact, a monstrous discussion going on among Trump administration officials about taking partial ownership of defense giants. I mean, Lockheed Martin makes 97% of their revenue from the U.S. government. They're basically an arm of the U.S. government, Lutnick said, adding that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Deputy Defense Secretary Steve Feinberg, do they have
okay, words, a push-up off? Words fail, but I'm not going to, but I actually have a lot to say about this. This is absurd. You know, this is a contract between a company and, you know, an arm of the U.S. government. It's a contract. It doesn't mean that the U.S. owns that, like, a proportionate amount or percentage of the company because it offers this service. This makes no logical sense whatsoever. I'm sorry for voicing this in a kind of...
We touched your nerve. That's okay, you know, Alexander. That's fine.
Stentorian way, you know, but this is absurd, you know. They have no understanding of what contract law is. You know, this doesn't mean that you have ownership of the company because it provides you a service. Now, if they're buying the shares of the company, 10% of Intel, that's another story. But, you know, Lutnick is, you know... I find his you talk about magical thinking. This is really mind bending.
But it's not magical thinking. Let me tell you what's happening in around the country in research and development. It's being cut at the federal level, and it's being reinstituted in specific cases in red states. So I know of specific situations where funded institutions in red states have been allowed to receive money and do research as long as money was not sent to blue states. As soon as there's a controlling interest in these industries, what they're going to do is they're going to start to dictate where industries can move, where they can set up, how they can set up. They're going to go after unions. They're going to go after blue states. They're going to go after the five-day work week. Okay, there is a method to this, and long term it's going to fundamentally change the country. But that's what they want, because they want to weaken California, in New York, in Illinois, in order to reward places like Texas or Oklahoma or Nebraska, which is literally dying on the vine right now because of both the tariffs and the immigration policy. This is part of a broader realignment of this country.
But I also don't see how this ultimately succeeds. I mean, first of all, small businesses are really the lifeblood of this country. I mean, you're talking about these major Fortune 100 corporations, and maybe they dive down and try to get controlling interests of some of the Fortune 5000 corporations. So that remains to be seen. But I also think that this idea that a government that a president ran on as wasteful, inefficient, corrupt, unable to do anything right, is now suddenly prepared to nationalize corporations across this country. And so I mean, look, anything could happen, but the path that you've identified and the scenario that you've identified, I do think that would take a very long time to play out, literally moving industries. Because you have these other things that are factors there, right? Where is the workforce? And where, more importantly, are the natural resources? You can move workforce to places, but where is there water? Where is there, assurances that, you know, the issues associated with climate are not going to impact these industries? I think it takes a very long time.
Again, Kathy, while you make a rational
argument. Mm. I will tell you right now that when you're talking about the resources of the taxpayers that are now going to be able to go in to build these big, beautiful plants, and your complete disregard for all regulations, think about the prison that's being built in the swamps of Florida. They're not going to worry about things like climate. They're not going to worry about those issues. I mean, this is just pure partisan politics.
And ultimately, like the Russian state, like the communist state, nationalization doesn't work.
You're absolutely correct, but that doesn't mean that that isn't what they're trying to do.
I do think, just to follow up on both of your comments, is that this is easier to do with certain categories of business that are linked specifically to natural resources. The Russian case right now is very instructive in that way, because you have two enormous companies, Gazprom, which literally means gas industry, Rosneft, which literally means Russia oil. These are technically, on paper, private corporations, and yet the Russian government owns, you know, a considerable percentage of the stock. I think Rosneft is something like at least 20%, if not higher. But those are already, you know, important kind of parts of the resource landscape, let me put it this way, of that country. What you're talking about is something is a little bit more, I guess, fluid. And I can easily see the kind of breaking down of some of the unions and other, you know, practices as being a kind of a prelude to the government buying out or having a greater share of the stocks in those companies. But that is going to be a longer process. And you know, it's going to come up against, like, the different elections.
It's not cycles. Going to happen overnight. But think about what we do with GM. Okay, the reason that GM was too big to fail, okay, wasn't just the vehicles, the making the vehicles themselves. It's actually the parts in all of the ancillary and tertiary businesses that impacted it. So when you start to talk about some of these big, big players, think about that. Think about where and who Boeing touches. I mean, at one point in time, Boeing had plants or operations in every single congressional district. I mean, so you don't need to control all of the industries. You just have to have your fingers on enough to be able to determine where the winners and the losers are.
But to what end? I mean, I think when you play that out, you are basically talking about a government that wants to eliminate the middle class. And I don't know of any place that I would want to live that does not have a strong middle class, even if I'm an oligarch. I mean, ultimately, you still need nurses. You still need teachers. You still need someone who is making your food. And so building your cars, doing this work and doing this labor. And so if the aim is to eliminate the middle class, eliminate workers' rights, make people less safe, make it more dangerous, you know, have our kids die younger, lower, the age, you know, the lifespan of people. Okay, but I do think at some point, people will wake up to that, and I hope that what you've painted is something that, sure, okay, on paper you might want to do it. I don't know why.
But Kathy, the health emergency was declared in Mississippi because of the level of deaths of babies. Okay, what's being done about that? And is Mississippi all of a sudden going to turn blue?
But I'm not sure I make the connection.
What I'm saying is that there are situations right now that would point to government intervention and people changing their behavior. Enough babies are dying in Mississippi right now to say that they have a health emergency, and nothing is being done about it.
And I think ultimately those are the things that Democrats need to run on.
I don't disagree with you. I just don't.
I mean,
don't
Robert, I think what you're talking about is something that would play out more palpably in the presidential election with the Electoral College map. I don't think it would be
exactly
as successful with, say, you know, some of the midterm elections.
This isn't for the midterms. this is definitely a longer play that would allow the government to put its fingers on the scale
and weaken the power of certain states. And I'd certainly put New York in that, but I definitely would say California. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, Washington, Oregon, you know, Illinois. I'm thinking about the blue states. I mean, and you can't look at what Trump is doing right now and say that this administration wouldn't punish either Democratic enclaves or states that don't vote red.
Oh, they already are.
They are. So yeah. why would you argue that they wouldn't be doing anything with this?
Playing it out to this idea that we would have a major reshuffling of industry and a complete elimination of the middle class in this country. I mean, you talk about the 5-day work week being eliminated. You talk about 12-hour work days, you know, shutting down OSHA, making people less safe. I do believe that we, as a Democratic Party, have the power, if that's the ultimate goal, to be able to rally people and fight that.
Well, they have gutted OSHA, right? And if you read Project 2025, they talk about labor and work week. You have a president who has come out and said he wants to do more, federal holidays, but not give people time off because people don't want more time off. They don't deserve it. So yeah, I mean. Again, it's all keeping with what he's saying. And this is the scary thing about this dude. He tells us what he's going to do before he screws us. And then we're shocked when he actually implements it.
Yeah, you get a lot of bang for the buck because there's sort of the whim, and then there's the pre-announcement, and then there's the announcement, and then there's the actual action.
Yeah.
But I think the core of supporters who somehow have this magical thinking is not large enough. Once you lead the lemmings off the cliff, the lemmings are gone.
Yeah.
What a great metaphor. I like that. All right. We're going to go to a break, but I want to leave with this note from Karen, who says, "Hello, panelists. The right and the conservative movements are no longer what they call themselves, just as the evangelical Christian movement is no longer following the teachings of their Messiah. To them, the Bible is too woke, you know, because of Jesus." Thank you for your discussion this morning, Karen. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We had mentioned earlier that there was a shooting in Minneapolis at a Catholic school, and the reports now coming out of the Minnesota Star Tribune and the mayor's office say that what was being called horrific violence, that the shooter has been contained as police respond to gunfire at the church. We'll have more on this during our newscast coming up at the top of the hour and during Midday Magazine as well. All right, let's go to one more topic and we will finish the day out, at least panel-wise, and we will go to another story, which I think is something that I want to talk to Alexander about, and that is Russia and Ukraine targeting energy sites, seeking leverage away from the front, and a lot of this being done as negotiations, go on between the United States and sending signals to Washington in case peace talks move forward. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that this development is the result of Trump capitulating to Putin's request that there be no ceasefire, because the war between the direct military engagement between Ukraine and the Russian Federation is very hot, but it hasn't really moved the needle in either direction significantly. So both countries are, essentially frustrated by this. This is kind of ironic given that the Russian Federation did not want a ceasefire during the negotiations, and Trump agreed to that, although that was contrary to what he initially said he wanted, which was a ceasefire. But, you know, that movement on both fronts is simply not really, it's not really, as I said, moving the needle in either direction for these two countries. And so Ukraine directly attacking the pipeline is an attempt to hit the Russian Federation where it really hurts, because it is an economy that is extremely dependent on the sale of and transportation of its energy resources, gas and oil. And disrupting that has already resulted in gas prices in the Russian Federation going up by 17%. So not to mention the fact that this has also created some dissatisfaction in Hungary and Slovakia, although the leaders of those two countries, Robert Fico in Slovakia and Viktor Orban in Hungary, are very angry at Ukraine now for doing this. But what this has done is sow some discontent, I would say, even among the supporters of those two leaders, because they have been consistently pushing an anti-Ukrainian policy and pro-Russia policy, and look what it has brought to their countries. Nothing that is of concrete benefit to their supporters.
So how are you interpreting this news that Exxon is in quiet conversations with Russian oil?
The way I interpret this is that, you know, that Exxon wanted to reassert its presence in the Russian Federation, which it lost in 2022 with, you know, the invasion of Ukraine. You know, I mean, what was called the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Exxon was thrown out of the Sakhalin Island and the Vladivostok area on the Pacific coast of the Russian Federation in 2022. And it wants to, you know, it wants to return to that territory. So, and to tap those resources again. It's not even political. It's like strictly according to their profit ledger.
And, you know, I would be interested in your perspective on the psychological toll at this point in time, which I feel is so much disproportionately impacting Ukraine with, you know, the air raids. I mean, all of these are you know, many believe directed by Russia to continue to undermine the morale and the psychological well-being of people in Ukraine. And when you add to that the threat of a very cold winter, you know, I had a colleague who I'd met in Ukraine when I traveled there a year ago, June, and she's now working with an NGO that is trying to address the fact that smoking rates in Ukraine have doubled since the war began. Yeah. People are not healthy. You know, this is taking its toll. And so another winter of this, in my mind, Russia has the upper hand on that, unfortunately. And how do we counteract that?
So it's interesting. It's an excellent question, Kathy. I mean, it seems to me that there's a lot of stress. You know, people are, you know, are relying on all sorts of ways of kind of offsetting, you know, their general level of despair and everyday fear. This is impacting, you know, demographically the health of the country. A useful analogy is the Bosnian War, you know, the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, where you had an absolutely defiant Bosnia fighting against Serbia, and on a smaller scale with Croatia, and cancer rates spiked in the country a few years after the beginning of the war, and other health issues as well. And yet, Bosnia remained defiant. It defended it successfully in the end, defended its territorial sovereignty. Right now, it seems that there's Ukrainians are guardedly hopeful because of this new strategy, because they're seeing that what happened in Alaska and in D.C. last week with the meetings of Zelensky and the other leaders didn't really lead to anything, you know, concrete. You know, Trump, like many Soviet leaders, is obsessed with these kind of photo ops and kind of ceremonial events that actually lead to no concrete policy changes. Mm-hmm. So this current stage of the war, my sense talking to some Ukrainians and, you know, reading some of the Ukrainian and Russian language news is that there's a bit of the needle is now in terms of morale moving in a positive direction for many Ukrainians. So we'll see what happens, though. I mean, it's a tricky question.
We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who joined us this morning and for all your great letters and comments. We thank you for that. Thanks also to Alexander Mihailovich, Robert Griffin, and Mayor Kathy Sheehan. Thank you all for your important insights and for being so cool. We appreciate it. We will return with more after this.